Welcome to our series of studies in Daniel. I should make a brief follow-up comment about retirement. You know, the Adventist version of retirement is twice the work and half the pay. So that's why we're here at camp meeting. Well, the book of Daniel is a very important book for us, isn't it? It's probably fair to say there wouldn't be an Adventist church if there wasn't a book of Daniel. You remember William Miller, our forefather, preached many in the thousands of prophetic sermons. But the heart of his prophetic sermons was Daniel 8:14. And I believe that what it says on his tombstone in upstate New York is, "Though the vision tarry, wait for it." So we're here waiting. But as the signs of the world develop, we probably won't have very much longer to wait, will we? Well, the book of Daniel is an unusual prophetic book. Half of its history and half of its prophecy. Most of the prophetic books of the Old Testament are not that way. If you look at Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, it's almost all prophecy. Very little biographical material or historical material about the prophet himself. In Daniel, it's divided half and half. Now, you don't have to be a good historian to be an Adventist, but it helps. And so we're going to spend today and tomorrow on the historical chapters, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday on the prophetic chapters. So we want to service to the historical chapters of the book, which are very interesting, and we can learn lessons from the life of Daniel and lessons from the prophecies of Daniel. Now, I want to start with a proverb and a story. And the proverb is, some of the greatest archaeological discoveries are made in the basements of museums. And the story is the story back of this book, which is basically the Near Eastern background of the book of Daniel. And it goes like this. There was a man named L.W. King working in the British Museum before World War I. And he published a book. And the title of the book was Chronicles of the Early Chaldean Kings. And he had tablets in the British Museum, cuneiform tablets, clay tablets with wedge-shaped writing on them, lined up on his desk. But he died in the year 1914. And those tablets sat there for 50 years collecting dust. And in 1956, the man who wrote this book, his name is Donald J. Wiseman, was walking by and he saw this stack of tablets on Professor King's desk. And he said to himself, I wonder what Professor King was studying. And he sat down and he started to study that new lineup of tablets. And what he found was a remarkable discovery. It was the cuneiform records, the tablets, from the first 13 years of King Nebuchadnezzar that we have in the book of Daniel. And so the title is Chronicles of the Chaldean Kings. You remember Nebuchadnezzar is a Chaldean, and he calls in the Chaldeans to interpret his dream and so on and so forth. Now, I met Professor Wiseman. He came to Philadelphia to teach a number of years ago. And I went down to meet him. I was living in Boston at the time. And it's interesting to note that he was a devoted Christian. He was a member of the Plymouth Brethren Church. Some of you may have heard of the Plymouth Brethren. They arose about the time that Adventism arose in the 1820s. And he told me this. He said, I think that God led me to those tablets. Now, I'm not going to cover the whole book with you, but I want to read one entry because it affects It affected Daniel. You see, these are year-by-year entries. The scribes in the palace in Babylon would compile the events on tablets. And then, after the year was over, they would make a summary which would just cover a few lines on a major tablet. And so two of these major tablets cover those first 13 years of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. And I want to read you the entry for the year 605. In the 21st year, the king of Babylon stayed in his own land. That's Nebuchadnezzar's father. Thank you. His name was Nabopolassar. His name isn't given here. But it is named Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, his eldest son, the crown prince, mustered the Babylonian army, took command of the troops. He marched to Carchemish, which is on the banks of the Euphrates, and crossed the river to go against the Egyptian army, which lay in Carchemish. They fought with each other, and the Egyptian army withdrew before him. He accomplished their defeat and non-existence. I like that phrase because of what follows. As for the rest of the Egyptian army, he just said he accomplished their non-existence, but some of them got away, which had escaped from the defeat so quickly that no weapon reached them in the district of Hamath, that's southern Syria. The Babylonian troops overtook them, defeated them, so that not a single man escaped to his country. At that time, Nebuchadnezzar conquered the whole area of Hatti country. Hatti country is an old name for Syria and Palestine because it used to belong to the Hittites that lived in Asia Minor in Turkey. Now, this was the turning event of the year 605. And it's also recorded in Jeremiah chapter 46 with a prophecy against Pharaoh that his army would be defeated by Babylon. Well, what does that have to do with Daniel? It had everything to do with Daniel. You see, up until this battle, Judea belonged to Egypt. Judah was under the control of the Egyptian pharaohs. In fact, his name was Pharaoh Necho. You may remember that when he was going up to one of these battles, he stopped to battle with good King Josiah and killed him. So Egypt was in control of Judea until the year 605. As a result of this battle, everything that belonged to Egypt, down to the border of Egypt itself, now belonged to Babylon. And so that brings us to the book of Daniel. And what happened as a consequence, in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, it says that Nebuchadnezzar came up against Jerusalem and besieged it. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, unfortunately for Judah, Jehoiakim was one of the bad kings. You know, you go back to the time of Samuel, and the people pled for a king. Give us a king that he may fight our battles for us. And so they got a king. But when you get a king, you are locked into the rule of genetic roulette. You see, in the period of the judges, the Spirit of God chose the leader. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. The Spirit of the Lord came upon the other judges. God chose the ruler. God chose the leader. But when you have a king, the kingship becomes hereditary, and you get whatever you get with the oldest son. And sometimes they were good. Occasionally you got a good king that way. Good King Josiah is one of them we mentioned. Good King Hezekiah. But more often than not, you got bad kings. And Jehoiakim was one of the bad kings. And he was the one who was always putting Jeremiah the prophet in prison. And he was the one, when they sent the scroll from Jeremiah the prophet, the inspired prophet of God, they sent the scroll to him, and they read it to him, and as they read it to him, he took a knife to it and threw it in the fire, piece by piece by piece. That's what he thought of the inspired prophet of God. And so, as a consequence, what happens here? The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. So Judah is conquered, Jerusalem is conquered, and Jehoiakim, this bad king, has to pay. And what does he pay with? The gold out of the temple. Now it's interesting to follow those vessels from the temple, because they make a link between the old temple, the first temple, and the second temple. Because here those vessels are taken away and put in the temple of the house of Nebuchadnezzar's God. And in the time of Cyrus, Cyrus takes those vessels out of the house of God in Babylon and sends them back to be put in the rebuilt temple. So the link between the old temple and the new temple were the vessels that belonged to the temple that were taken as tribute. But he took something else. He took hostages. And he took young men. And it's interesting to notice the qualifications for these young men. And we read that in Daniel chapter 1, verse 4. He wanted youths in whom was no defect. All right, they're physically sound, who were good looking, all right, physical beauty, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge. Four different characteristics that have to do with their mental abilities, not just their physical abilities. Now, this was a common practice in the ancient world. The Egyptians did it, the Babylonians did it, the Assyrians did it. They would take these promising young men, take them back to the major capital, Memphis in Egypt, or Nineveh in Assyria, or Babylon for the Babylonians, and they would educate them, and they were supposed to learn respect for the great power that they studied under there. And occasionally, what would happen, when a governor of a province would die, they would take a young man who had been trained and send him back to be governor of the province where he came from. So this is standard practice here. And they take youths, about teenagers. Now, just 2 weeks ago, we had a graduation over in the other side of this building. And most of the young people in the graduating class would have been 17 or 18, maybe a little younger. And so you can think of plucking one of those graduates and making him walk 400 to 600 miles on foot as a prisoner with no sign of any intervention of God, no voice of God speaking to him, and everything looks dreary, and you're wrenched out of your own home setting. What are you going to do? What would you do? Well, we know what Daniel did, because that's why we have a book in the Bible. Because like Joseph, he determined in his heart that he would be faithful and true to the God whom he served, even though he's just a teenager. And so, even though there was a hidden God, that God was behind the curtains at this time, Daniel and his friends still determine they will serve their God. And that's what we have in the story, in the historical chapters of the book of Daniel. We have the way their experience worked out. Well, they get to Babylon and they're put in school. So now they finished high school and they got to go to college. They have to go to Babylonian U. And the first problem they run into is they don't like the food. Have you ever heard that from students before? My oldest daughter spent 2 years at Andrews and 2 years at Michigan State, Michigan State University. And one time when I was visiting there in Lansing, I went to a museum on campus. And in the museum, there was the story of how the student newspaper started. The year was 1880. And the student newspaper at Michigan State University started because the students wanted to complain about how bad the food was. So there's nothing new under the sun. And the food in the cafeterias is still bad, every place except here. But there was something else wrong with the food. And so Daniel and his friends asked their overseer, "Look, we don't want to be defiled by the king's food. We don't want any offense, but we don't want to eat that stuff." There are probably several reasons for that. We have tablets which tell about the rations or food supplies for the Babylonian army, and it included pork. So there were unclean meats being served. Then it's possible that they were offered to idols. And it's probably had something also to do with the highly spicy foods that they served. And so there were several reasons why these Israelite young men had objections to the diet. But, you know, you don't want to bring bad news to the king, because you know what happens to the messenger who brings bad news to the king. The messenger suffers as a consequence. So the overseer protests and says, "Well, look, I'll be in trouble if I don't serve you the king's food from the king's table here." So Daniel proposes a test. And he says, "Give us what we want to eat for just 10 days. And it says, at least in my translation, the new NASB that I'm reading from, it says, "Give us vegetables and water to drink for 10 days as a test." The actual literal word behind the word vegetables is seed food. That is to say, food grown from seeds. So it's obviously a vegetarian diet, maybe even a vegan diet. Now you might say, well, 10 days, you know, what can you accomplish in 10 days? Well, you can accomplish a lot in 10 days. You can, on the Pritikin diet, you can lower your cholesterol 50 points. And so they undergo grudgingly, the overseer permits them to take the test. And they come out physically better. And so they pass the test. And so he permits them to continue on that diet for the 3 years that they were studying in the Babylonian university. And at the end of the 3 years, they have to have an oral examination. And it's interesting the way it puts it here, that God gave them, you know, what the king was looking for in the qualifications. It says God gave them, verse 17, "As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams." So what the king was looking for, God gave them. It's interesting to see how certain experiences occur where God seems to intervene on behalf of faithful students. Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon, the Adventist neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins, tells the story about when he went to the Massachusetts General Hospital for an interview for a residency position. And as he sat in the room waiting to go in for the oral examination before a board of doctors, he said to himself, "Well, let's see, what shall I review? I think I'll look at the hormones of the pituitary gland." And he walked in to the examination, and one of the first questions asked him by one of the surgeons who was on the board there said, "Please review the hormones of the pituitary gland for us." I had the same experience at the University of Michigan. I was living in Berrien Springs at the time, and it's a 3-hour drive. I was writing my comprehensive examinations for the doctor's degree, and one of them was in ancient history. And so I arrived a little early. I was sitting in my car and said, "Well, what shall I study?" There was a kingdom of people in the Bible. They're known as Hurrians. Maybe you've heard of the Hurrians or Horites. And their kingdom on the upper Euphrates was known as the kingdom of the Mitanni. And so I just happened to flip open the book to the kingdom of the Mitanni. I reviewed the kings and what they did. And this is about the 15th century BC, shortly before the time of Moses. So I walked into the examination. You have 3 hours to write on 5 questions. And one of the 5 questions was, discuss the Mitanni kingdom. But I had an even better shot at it. My wife and I also have medical licenses, and we worked for 4 years on the island of Trinidad in the West Indies. And so while there, to get a license to practice medicine there, we had to take examinations in Canada, because Canada and Trinidad were former colonies. So we had to have a British medical license. Now, it was the same sort of situation. You have a written and an oral, written and oral, written and oral. For the oral examination in surgery, I walked in, and I must preface this by saying I was wearing a bow tie. I always used to wear bow ties when I taught at the seminary. And it was a bow tie which I had bought on Vancouver Island when my wife and I were on our honeymoon. And it was a Scotch plaid. And my first question on the surgery oral was, where did you get that bow tie? Because the bow tie was in the plaid of the Macbeth tartan. And Dr. Macbeth was one of the 3 surgeons that I had to be examined by. Needless to say, I came through that exam with flying colors. Well, sometimes God can do unusual things for you. And he did unusual things for Daniel and his 3 friends. And I want you to notice, as we review this chapter, I want you to notice 3 places in the text where it says, God gave. All right, verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. That is, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you might say, that's not a very good thing, but here's a wicked king who deserved his fate. But the innocents among the nobles of Judea didn't deserve that fate. So what are you going to make out of it? All right, the second place, verse 9. Now God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. So you see, the first one is negative. Second one is positive. And the third one is very positive. And that's verse 17. As for these 4 youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence and so forth. So you may not have been the brightest student, but James says, whoever lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who giveth freely. And so he gave wisdom and intelligence and even a knowledge of dreams to Daniel and his friends. So we have God gave, God gave, God gave. But if you think about Daniel trudging across the desert, a hostage and a captive, swept away from his own land, never to see it again, you might say the logical question that he would ask, and I'm sure they probably did, where is God in all this? But you see, when God inspires Daniel to write up the record of his experience, he pulls the curtain back and shows that he was right there behind the curtains all the time. And it may be that way with you in your life and your experiences. Things happen to you and you say, why me? Why this? But one day, God will pull back the curtain and he'll show you that his purposes and his plans were not thwarted by what the devil could bring into your life. Ellen White says in the book Desire of Ages about John the Baptist as he languished in prison. And remember, here's the man whom Jesus said, among men, risen among women, there's not a greater than John the Baptist. And how did he die? By having his head chopped off. But Ellen White says of him, as he languished in that prison, if God could have pulled back the curtain and shown him the purpose that he was accomplishing for God, he would not have chosen to have anything different in his life than it was. So the bad times may come. God doesn't call you just to be Rice Christians. He calls you to stand for Him regardless of the circumstances, good, bad, or indifferent. And Daniel and his friends did that. And that's the lesson we can gather from chapter 1. And they did that even though they could not see God behind the purposes of the time. They couldn't see what God was accomplishing in the fall of Judah. They couldn't see what God was accomplishing in their captivity. But God had a purpose. You know, we think of this time, we call it the Babylonian exile. This was just the beginning. Nebuchadnezzar came back two more times to Judah. Daniel went with the first wave of exiles. 7 years later, Ezekiel went with a second wave of exiles. And with the third wave, the whole city and country were demolished, and the rest of the population were sent into captivity. And you might say, well, where was God in all that? It's an interesting fact that the single largest portion of the Bible was written at that time. Now, add it up. We have three prophets in three different locations. We have Daniel in the court of Babylon, 12 chapters. We have Jeremiah in Jerusalem, 52 chapters. And we have Ezekiel with the captives in Babylon, 48 chapters. 48, 52, that's 100 chapters of the Bible right there. And Daniel makes 112. Was God quiet? Was God silent at this time? Absolutely not. 112 chapters of the Bible came out of that experience. So you see, if God had been silent and never spoken, the people in Babylon, the exiles, the hostages, the captives, they might have said, there isn't any God. He didn't guide or direct. He has no hand in human affairs. But God sends His prophets to three different critical locations to show that He was right there, and He knew it all, and He showed it all, and He told them why it all happened and where it was going after that. The restoration prophecies in Ezekiel, the restoration prophecies in Jeremiah, and the apocalyptic prophecies in Daniel that go on beyond that. Well, Daniel and his friends are in Babylon. They're studying at Babylon U, and we have a good idea of what they studied. They obviously studied Aramaic. They spoke Hebrew, of course. Aramaic is very close to Hebrew. It's about the difference between Spanish and Italian. So it was easy to learn Aramaic. And they studied mathematics. We have a lot of mathematical tablets from Babylon. And they studied astronomy. And probably, if they had to study astrology, they probably didn't take it very seriously. But they could study the astronomical basis. And they studied the Babylonian language, which was also a Semitic language, but a little more distant than Aramaic. And they studied the Babylonian writing system, and that was not easy. See, God gave the Jews and the Phoenicians and the people that lived in the West an alphabet. You don't realize how fortunate you are to write with an alphabet. The alphabet for the Babylonians was 625 cuneiform signs. And in order to write that stuff, you had to learn all 625 of those signs. so that the kings of Babylon and Assyria could not read and write. There was one Assyrian king who learned how to read and write, and he bragged about it in his tablets. So reading and writing in Babylon, because of the cumbersome writing system, was the province of the scribes, the technocrats. But in Judea, the common person could read and write because you have a simple alphabet of 22 letters. See, their alphabet was even shorter than ours. We have 26 letters, they had 22. And that makes it easy, because in an hour you can learn all those 22 letters. And we have a case in the book of Judges where Jephthah's chasing the Ammonites. And he stops at a village and asks a young man, "Who are the elders of this town that wouldn't help me?" And the young man writes down the names of the elders. He can write. If you stopped at a town in Babylon, they couldn't write. They couldn't have done it. You'd have to hunt down the scribes in the city. So God gave a gift to the people of God with their writing system. You know, there have been a few great inventions that have pushed along the Word of God. The invention of the alphabet in the time and place where Moses lived out in Sinai. That's the beginning of the alphabet. And then Gutenberg comes along with movable print, movable type, so that the Bible, instead of being hand copied, you could print. It is said that in 1450, when approximately the time when Gutenberg invented movable print, there were 100,000 books in Europe. And by the end of that century, the 15th century, there were 1 million because of the printing. And the most common one of all was the Bible. And so it's the democratization of the Word of God to be able to spread it so that everybody can read it. And Tyndale stands before the Bishop Tunstall in England and says, "If God gives me life, before long I'll have the man behind the plow will know more about the Word of God than you do." Because of the spread and translation and spread of the Word of God. Well, we come to chapter 2. We'll do that also this morning. It's part of the historical chapters, but it's really prophetic. In actuality, Daniel does not really serve as a prophet here. He serves as what we might call an inspired wise man. God doesn't give him the dream primarily. He gives the dream to the king. And the king, as you know so well in the story, is disturbed the next morning. He can't eat breakfast because of that nightmare he had. But he can't remember what the nightmare was. So he calls in the wise men. Now, an interesting feature of the book of Daniel is it's written in two languages. There are just a few books of the Bible that are written in two languages. The book of Ezra is written in two languages because the decrees of the Persian kings are given in Aramaic, and the rest of the book is in Hebrew. There's one verse in Jeremiah that's Aramaic, and there's one verse in Genesis that's Aramaic. And Daniel's the other book that has two languages. And people have always puzzled why. Chapter 2 to chapter 7 are in Aramaic. Chapter 1 and chapter 8 through 12 are in Hebrew. I don't have a final answer for that question, but I think there's a partial answer here because of when the Aramaic language starts. And it starts in verse 4, chapter 2. So the Chaldeans come to the king, and they spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever, tell the dream." And that's where the Aramaic writing starts in. So the Aramaic language is a function of direct address, and it continues until the end of the prophecy in Daniel 7. So the king makes a most unusual request. Now, interpretation of dreams and magic And predictions were common, very, very common in Nineveh and in Babylon. You may have heard of the library of King Ashurbanipal. A lot of it is astrology. Or how to read livers. They would kill a sheep, they'd take the liver, and if one knob of the liver was a little bigger than the other side, they'd say, well, this means thus and so is going to happen. So they had all, if a child with congenital anomalies was born, it was taken as a sign that thus and so was going to happen. So these texts are full of this kind of stuff. Astrology, signs. So these are the professionals at it. But the professionals can't do the job. And so the king can see that these guys are just putting on a front. He says, well, look, anybody can tell you a dream, and you can give the interpretation of the dream. You can say anything. But if you really want to show that you really know what you're doing, tell me the dream too. That's a little harder. And so he says, you're a bunch of rascals. This is fraud, and you're going to lose your necks over it. And he issues a death decree. But news of the death decree comes to Daniel. And so he asked the man, whose name now in chapter 2 is Arioch, he asked him if he could go before the king and talk to the king about this. And so that's what we have along about in verses 14 to 16. And so he is given time. He is given time, so they go home, and that night they have a prayer meeting. What a prayer meeting. Have you ever prayed when your life was dependent upon it? Well, some of you may have been soldiers in a trench in a war someplace. And as they say, there's no atheists in foxholes. So you may have prayed as if your life counted upon it. But they knew if they didn't get an answer to this prayer, the following morning they were going to be executed. But God graciously gives them not only the dream, but the interpretation of the dream. And there's this beautiful poem of glory to God. Daniel, of course, always attributes all of this to God, not to himself or his own wisdom. Verse 19, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven and said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given the wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you. See, that's the theme of the book of Daniel. He sets up kings and he takes down kings. As we look at human history, it may seem to us that there's no order or explanation or purpose to it all. Not so. Joseph Stalin was talking about the Pope, and he said, how many divisions of troops does he have? And look where Stalin is today. We have recently commemorated the falling of the Wall of Berlin. President Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. And it came down. So that today we have a united Germany in front of us. One of the themes of the book of Daniel is the question of who has dominion. And that's one of the themes of the prophecy that was given here. And one of the themes of the prophecy in Daniel chapter 7. And so Babylon had dominion for a time, but they lost it. And Persia had dominion for a time, but they lost it. And Greece had dominion for a time, but they lost it. And Rome had dominion for a time, but they lost it. And so it goes. And so we are here, victims to this ever ongoing cycle of new rulers after old rulers, new rulers after old rulers, and sometimes, or maybe even quite frequently, the new rulers are worse than the old rulers. And we ask the question, will it ever be like this? Is there no answer to it? But in this vision, and in the rest of the visions of the book of Daniel, God gives Daniel the answer. And the answer here in this vision is the stone kingdom. But before the stone kingdom comes, there is the sequence of metals. Now, this is the basic skeleton vision or dream of the book of Daniel. The image just stands there. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't walk away. He doesn't go over and conquer something. He just stands there and exists. And so as there was a sequence of metals, so there was to be a sequence of kingdoms. And the sequence, of course, is gold, silver, bronze, iron, iron mixed with clay. And as I've often said, a good Adventist can say Babylon, Media, Persia, Greece, and Rome faster than a Catholic can spin their prayer beads. How do we know that sequence? Well, it starts with the interpretation. When we get to verse 36, you, O king, are that head of gold. And then he goes on to say, after you will arise another kingdom. Notice the word kingdom, inferior to you. Very interesting that he would say, you, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the kingdom of Babylon. There's a good reason for that. The Neo-Babylonian kingdom lasted 70 years. And during those 70 years, Nebuchadnezzar reigned for 43 of them. And he also built the kingdom of Babylon, the empire of Babylon, by military conquest. And he built the city of Babylon. So you could say that Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon were virtually equivalent. And what came after Nebuchadnezzar was a series of lesser, more unimportant kings until we get to Belshazzar of chapter 5, and we'll see him tomorrow. So Persia follows, and after Persia comes Greece. And we have the story of the transition to Persia right in the book of Daniel. The transition to Greece happened after the Old Testament ended. And then finally comes Rome in the time of Jesus. And if you'll excuse me, I'd like to use a chair. Now there's a very interesting feature here, which shows directly divine inspiration. It's not just that this image covers 2,500 years of history. You see, liberals, critical scholars critical of the Bible say, well, yes, a prophet could guess what was to happen immediately after their own time. For instance, Jeremiah, he could see that Nebuchadnezzar was stronger than Judea. But to guess what was going to happen 500 or 700 or 800 or 1,000 years in advance, that's impossible. That's impossible to the rational human mind. But to God, it is not impossible. And that's what he gave Daniel here. And there's a proof right in the prophecy itself that that was the case. You see, critics of the book of Daniel say it was written in the 2nd century B.C., not in the 6th century. The book itself presents itself as having been written in the 6th century B.C. So we have these two points of view. Was Daniel written in the 6th century B.C. or the 2nd century B.C.? Well, historical evidence, like we've cited this morning already, shows that really that it was written in the 6th century B.C. But let's take the case. Let's take the case that it might have been written in the 2nd century B.C. If this was an ordinary human guess, what would you say was going to come? What was going to happen? Well, we have four kingdoms, right? Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. So we should have had a fifth kingdom, a sixth kingdom, a seventh kingdom. It should keep going like that, right? Or the alternate human theory would be that Rome would stand forever. You know, Hitler thought the Third Reich was going to stand for 1,000 years. It lasted about 5 years. So man proposes, but God disposes. So let's take the alternative that Rome was going to stand forever. In fact, Josephus, when he writes up this prophecy, says that. And there's a reason why he says that, because he's writing to a Roman audience. And he wants to show the Romans what a great people they have conquered in Judea. So he doesn't mention the divided kingdom or the stone kingdom to follow. So these would be the two natural human guesses. If you have four kingdoms, you'll have a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, and so forth. Or the fourth kingdom, the iron kingdom that smashes and crushes, will stand forever. Daniel does not follow either of those ordinary human theories. He says there'll be just four world kingdoms, four Mediterranean world kingdoms, and the fourth one will be divided. How did he know that? He knew that because God told him. He picks the least likely human alternative because God showed it to him. He does not take the two human alternatives, rationalistic, humanistic alternatives. He picks the one which God has shown him. So there's evidence right here in this prophecy that this is indeed an inspired prophecy from God, that God knew not only what was going to happen in general in the future, but precisely what was going to happen. And so it did. I'll tell you my own personal experience with Daniel chapter 2. I was raised in a household where my mother was an Episcopalian and my father was an agnostic. So we got to church once in a while, at least Christmas and Easter, but not very often. So we moved to a town, Ontario, California, and we just happened to end up across the street from a family of Seventh-day Adventists with teenagers my age with whom I went to school. And they invited me to their church. And so I went. To show you how religious I was, this was Easter Sunday. I had been painting our house. I had paint-spattered cords and paint-spattered t-shirt when I went into the Adventist church. And there was the image of Daniel 2. First time I ever entered the Adventist church. The image of Daniel 2, my first encounter with the Adventist church. And ever since, I've been indebted to the book of Daniel. Well, this is my experience with the book of Daniel. And the prophecy of the book of Daniel is true. The course of history is followed as it is shown here. And so we can have faith and trust and confidence in the Word of God and in the book of Daniel and in the messages as they become more detailed as they follow through.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.